Good evening, everybody. It's good to be with you on this beautiful Lord's Day evening. If you have a Bible and you'd like to follow along, please turn open to Romans chapter 1. We'll be reading there in just a little bit. Romans chapter 1. While we were singing the song about count your many blessings, name them one by one, I was naming a few in my head. Number one, Jesus. First one that came to my mind, my wife, my son, and you. This is a blessing. It's a blessing to be here. It's a blessing to be a part of this congregation. And to preach for you is a blessing as well. I took a public speaking class and I got a C. I got a C in a public speaking class. Went on to be a public speaker. One of the reasons is that I disregarded all of the rules. One of the rules in public speaking class was don't start your class with a bunch of, or your discourse, with a bunch of statistics. Well, let me bore you with a few. This lesson's about gambling. Please excuse the titles of that slide there. Gambling is a huge problem in the United States of America, and you will see that in just a moment as we put these statistics on the board. Today is one of the biggest gambling days of the year. Super Bowl Sunday. $200 million will be wagered today on the Super Bowl, and they'll wager, or 2 million people will wager on the Super Bowl, and they'll wager $8 billion. That's a worldwide statistic. Worldwide, people will be wagering on today's game. 73% of adults, 16 and over, which I found that amazing that it was 16 and over because you're not even legal to gamble at 16 and over. But that's when our society considers people adults. 73% of adults gambled in some shape or form in 2010, a 5% increase in 2007. Now you might think, Alan, why would you put up a 2010 statistic or a 2007 statistic? That's years ago. Here's why. You know what happened in 2008 and 9? A thing we called the Great Recession. A Great Recession happened, and gambling went up. I guess gambling is a recession-proof business to be in. I guess this country hasn't learned very many lessons from that. 2 to 3% of Americans have a gambling addiction. This is twice or three times as bad as it is internationally. Now you might say, well, 2 to 3% doesn't sound like a lot, but if you consider our population, we have millions of people in the United States who are addicted to gambling. Gross revenue exceeds $95 billion a year, and that's just revenue. That's what the lotteries make. That's profit. That's casino profit. That's not how much is actually being wagered. So if that's how much they're bringing home, how much is actually being wagered? In the 1970s, there were only two states where any form of gambling was legal at all. And now there are 48 states where some form, at least a lottery, is legal. Utah and Hawaii are the only holdouts. Good for them. In 1996, Indian gaming was the fastest growing industry in the world. And that is not a misprint. It wasn't that the fastest growing industry in America, the fastest growing industry in the entire world, percentage-wise. And lastly, gambling affects all ages. 65 or older, that's the greatest percentage of people who visit Vegas. 87%, I didn't put this on the board, but 87% of people who go to Vegas gamble. However, the age group that's becoming addicted the fastest, wouldn't you know, would be teenagers. I used to think, when I was in an audience like this, listening to preaching, that when the preacher encouraged parents to monitor their children's behavior over the internet, I used to think that was old and fuddy-duddy. I guess I'm old now. Because parents, and I'm encouraging myself, when my son has access to the internet, monitor your children's behavior on the internet. Now, when I heard it 10, 15 years ago, it was about pornography and it was about your children talking to creepos on online chat sites and whatnot. But this has become an epidemic in every sense of the word. Monitor your children's behavior online. It's serious. But you see, the problem of gambling is not gambling. And throughout this lesson, one of the things that I really want to stress on you is that there is a deeper problem behind gambling. And if we'll all be honest with ourselves, which I hope that you will be, we do struggle with some of the attitudes that are behind gambling. The first of which is covetousness. And that's why we have you here in Romans chapter 1. The context of Romans chapter 1 is that God will eventually give up on people. The existence of God and His attributes are so clearly seen, Paul says in this chapter, that people are without excuse. Atheists are without an excuse. God and His attributes, His eternal power, they are clearly seen, Paul says. But if you want to sin, if you want to reject Him, God will eventually say, that's fine, go ahead, do it. Three times the phrase is used in this passage, God gave them up. Read verse 24, therefore God gave them up into the lusts of their heart to impurity. Verse 26, God did what? God gave them up to dishonorable passions. And now verse 28, since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God did what? He gave them up to a debased mind. Now, when you think of something that is debased, what is the first things that come to your mind? Probably the heinous sins of our culture, right? Pedophiles, some sexual sins, murder. That's what we think of when we think of something that's debased. But he's about to give us a list of things that is debased. And some of the things in this list might be surprising, like disobedience to parents, gossip, and covetousness. Continue reading in verse 29. They are filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. And you know what people deserve when they practice these things? Verse 32. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. The gossip deserves to die just like the murderer does. And the covetous man deserves to die just as much as the pedophile does. Covetousness. You say, Alan, I'm not convinced that gambling is covetousness. I'm convinced that they are exact parallels. Consider the meaning of the word, covetousness. It means to gain something, to get something at the loss of another person. And in gambling, you cannot win without the loss of another person. Now you might say, you might excuse yourself by saying, well, I don't want my fellow blackjack players or my fellow fantasy football players, and fantasy leagues have become a big problem in the gambling realm. I don't want my fellow lottery players to lose. Well, guess what? That's the only way that you can win, is if four people pulled that slot machine and lost, and you happen to win once. The only way that lotteries can actually pay out is by millions of people losing. The only way blackjack dealers can pay out is if 10 people before you actually lost, or five, or whatever. There's only one way to win in gambling, at the loss of another person. So is that not an exact parallel to gambling? In the Ten Commandments, one of the Ten Commandments was, you shall not covet. Now we quote that as the Tenth Commandment, but God was actually much more specific when He gave the Ten Commandments. He said, you shall not covet, and then He went on to be more specific. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, their servant, their ox, their donkey, or their house, or whatever. Anything that is your neighbor's. Well, if you gain your neighbor's servant, somebody's losing, right? Your neighbor. If you gain your neighbor's ox, who's losing? Your neighbor. And if that's not an exact parallel to gambling, I don't know what is. I looked up this word covetousness in Strong's, and he says that it almost always implies being fraudulent about your gaining. And isn't it interesting that the form of gambling that they always put on ESPN or television networks, the only times that they ever put it on is the games that include lying? How come they don't put blackjack or slot machines on TV? How come it's always a poker game? Those are the games that you have to lie in. You ever heard of a bluff? You're lying. You're acting like you got aces in the hole and you got a three of diamonds and a four of clubs. You don't got a thing. But you're acting like it. And so you go about with this fraudulent act. You put on a poker face, people say. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Let's read more about this covetousness. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 3, Paul says, "But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you as is proper for the saints." Don't let gambling be named among the saints at Monta Vista. I know it didn't say gambling, but that's the same Greek word that is used in Romans chapter 1, to gain at the loss of another. He goes on, verse 5, "For you may be sure of this." Can I put a little pun on it? You can bet on this. You can bank on it, we say sometimes. You can bank on this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure, or who is covetous, that is an idolater. He kind of qualifies it and says, these covetous people are really just idolaters bowing at the altar of money. They have no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ or God. You want to bet on something? You can bet on the fact that any covetous person will not have an inheritance in God's kingdom. They do not go together. And the seriousness of how God deals with covetous people is seen throughout the scripture. I think one of the strongest things that ever happened with a covetous person was in Joshua chapter 7. You remember Joshua was leading the armies of Israel into the land of Canaan. And the first city that they sacked was Jericho. They marched around the city. They blew the trumpets. They did exactly what God would have them do. And the walls came down flat. They invaded Jericho with ease. It was easy breezy. The next city was smaller, so Joshua sends a little detachment of spies to say, well, go spy out this city. See how easy it's going to be or how hard it's going to be. The spies come back to Joshua and they say, this is going to be a joke in comparison to Jericho. And they say, if you send all of the army, it's just going to be a waste of resources and time and energy. Just send a small detachment. Joshua says, I got no problem with that. They send a small detachment into a city called Ai, and they got their behinds whooped. Now, why did God not bless them with victory? Because it was God doing the victory and the losing, or causing them to lose. It was because of a man being covetous. Joshua hears of the report, and he prays to God and says, God, why did you not bless us with victory? God says there's sin in the camp. Remember what that sin was? Achan, when they defeated Jericho, he actually uses the word coveted. I coveted the spoil. And God was very explicit about telling them, don't take any of that spoil back. But he says, I coveted it. And he hid it underneath his tent. And because of that, they lost some people's lives there at Ai. And Achan loses his lives later in that chapter. I'm just asking this out loud, but I wonder if God withholds blessings from congregations because they will not rid themselves of covetousness. Just like God did not bless the army of Israel with victory. Just think about that. May covetousness and gambling, may it not even be named among the saints at Monta Vista. Here's another deeper problem, a deeper attitude behind gambling. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. Discontentment. Begin reading with me in verse 6, if you will. Verse 6 of 1 Timothy 6, and we'll read through verse 10. Now there is great gain in godliness with contentment. Verse 7. And he gives us a good reason why to be content. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction.
For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. You know, one of the books of the Bible that I think illustrate how riches and possessions and property do not satisfy is the book of Ecclesiastes, which we just got done studying a little while ago in our Bible classes. He had it all. Solomon had it all. All the power, all the wealth, all the property, all the possessions, and yet it did not satisfy. And isn't that what Paul is saying here in 1 Timothy chapter 6? The satisfied life comes with a life of godliness that is combined with contentment. And one of the greatest reasons to be content, he says in verse 7, is that we came into the world with the same things that we're going to go out of this world with. Nothing. So let's just say that somebody in this audience actually wins the $171 million that the lottery is offering now. One of the bad things about writing a lesson on gambling is that now I'm attracted to all the commercials, the casinos there, and all the billboards. $171 million, I saw one the other day. So somebody in here wins $171 million, and a week later they die. Big deal. Big deal. But let's say that they live out for 30 or 40 years. What's going to happen then? Surely they'll be satisfied with $171 million, right? Well, if you love money, one of the things that Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 is that if you love money, there is never enough. There's never enough money. You know how I love Dateline. There was a Sunday night Dateline special where they gathered up these lottery winners. And 10 or 15 years later, they reported on them and what their finances look like. I think they said 75%, 3 out of 4, were either struggling or had filed for bankruptcy. One lady from Tennessee, she actually hired a private investigator to say, I think someone's stealing my money. The private investigator came in and he said, lady, you're just spending more money than what you think. And if I didn't know any better, when he describes in verse 9, those who fall into temptation because they want a desire to be rich, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires, if I didn't know better, I would think that Paul was telling Timothy about people who want to win big. It's not a life of satisfaction, brethren. It will only plunge us into ruin. The love of money, that desire to want to be rich and win big. We need to be content, even with food and clothing. Paul says we will be content. The deeper problem is a failure to recognize who the true provider of blessings is. Stay in this chapter, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, and read with me verse 17. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty. So is it a sin to be rich? Clearly not. He doesn't say, charge the rich to stop getting rich, to charge the rich to get rid of all their riches. That's not what he says. But he says, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with all things to enjoy, with everything to enjoy. So he tells Timothy to charge the rich people to do two things. Number one, do not be haughty. You know, there's a temptation, even if you're not rich, to believe that your skill, your work ethic, your education, your hours are putting food on the family's table. You know, sometimes when I think about my family and how we're doing, and sometimes those thoughts can creep into my mind. But who is it really? Is it your skill, your ability? Or is it God richly providing, according to this verse? Don't be haughty. There's a reason why a lot of arrogant people are rich, or a lot of rich people are arrogant. I don't know which way to put it. Because the richer you are, I think there's a more temptation, there's a bigger temptation to have that feeling that I'm doing this. I did this. I have this account. I have this business. Be careful. recognize the God who richly provides. And the second thing he tells them to do is not to put their hope on the uncertainty of riches. If our great recession taught us anything, and it taught us a lot of things, it's that riches are uncertain, right? It comes and goes. Markets fall. But put your hope on God. He'll provide. He'll provide. A lack of self-control. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. This passage has nothing to do with money that I can actually see, but the principle of being addicted. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 12, if you will. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 12. Paul says, "All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything." You could rightly paraphrase that last part when Paul says, "I will not be enslaved." By paraphrasing it, "I will not be addicted." Now, he goes on to talk about sexual sins, which there's a lot of sexual sins that can become incredibly addicting. Now, why would we go to a passage about addiction and sexual sin to talk about gambling? Get this. I came across an article on gambling and what happens in your mind, the hormones, the endorphins. I'm not a scientist. I don't understand all this. But listen to this. The brain is where everything starts. Hormones are released by the brain, and these create endorphins, which give you that mental and emotional high and makes you feel good. Addiction-prone people have a shortage of these hormones in their brains. So when they gamble, the feeling that accompanies the activity stimulates the release of these endorphins, and this creates a false sense of well-being. Now, that might be over my head, but the article goes on to say, pornography addicts, the same thing happens. Hormones are released. It creates these endorphins and this false sense of well-being. So why do I go to a passage about addiction and sexual sins? Well, as far as what's happening in your brain, it might not be that different. But Paul didn't limit what he said he would not be enslaved by, right? Paul said, "I will not be enslaved by anything." And it doesn't matter whether it's food or whether it's drugs, alcohol, porn, or gambling. We need to have the self-control to say, no. No. The deeper problem is poor stewardship. Chuck Floyd said this at the Lord's table. And we just sang a song that said this very thing, that all of the world is our Father's. I'm not going to turn to all of these passages, but Exodus 19, verse 5, Deuteronomy 10, verse 14, Job 41, verse 11, Psalm 24, verse 1, 50 and verse 12, that is Psalm, and 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 26, do you know what they all say? The exact same thing. The earth is the Lord's, and all it contains, or the fullness thereof, the older versions say. I love the poetic way it puts that. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness. So when we gamble, you know whose money we're gambling with? It's God's. Everything is God's. One of the excuses that gamblers give is, well, it's my money. God has given me my choice over what to do with my money, and that's right. But I think that's the problem, is that when just because we have free will to do what we want with our money, that does not indicate ownership. Let me say that again. Just because we have complete free will over our money does not indicate ownership. We will all hear the words of that dishonest manager in Luke chapter 16. Give an account of your stewardship. Give an account of your stewardship. Give an account of your management. Well, Vera and I bought a Ford Fusion in 2013. Can you imagine telling the Lord all the things that you bought? And all the benevolent things? I know that we are not saved by our works. I know that, and I don't want anybody to get that indication. I'm simply saying, write it down. Write the things down that you do with your money. And then ask yourself, am I being a good steward of what God has blessed us with? The deeper problem is wanting something for nothing. Turn in your Bibles, please, to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. I saved this one for last, because I think that this is a huge problem, or it's becoming a bigger problem in the United States of America. I did not know whether I should put this in, because it's very touchy, but I'm going to try to be eloquent and as soft on this issue as I can. We are living in a society that depends on handouts and is growing and is increasing in our addiction to handouts. Government handouts, church handouts, family handouts. And I just preached a lesson not too long ago about the church in Antioch and how they were sympathetic to the financial problems of their brethren in Judea. And I stick to that point, that we need to be sensitive to the financial needs around us. But every time that the Bible talks about financial relief, 99% of the time, it is talking about temporary relief. Now, I think you can make an argument for 1 Timothy chapter 5, where it talks about widows being enrolled. I think there's an argument there. But 99% of the time, financial relief is always temporary. You know what the ideal is? 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning in verse 10. For that is indeed what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to do this more and more, talking about their love. Now verse 11. And to aspire to live quietly, mind your own affairs, to work with your hands, get a J-O-B, as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly before outsiders. And then there's a little phrase at the end of verse 12. To be dependent on no one. To be dependent on no one. This is not making people feel bad for accepting temporary financial relief. We don't want you to feel bad. In fact, we want you to speak up. If there's a temporary financial relief that needs to be handled in your life, speak up. But what this is talking about is permanently relying on handouts. Government handouts, church handouts, family handouts, you name it. And that's not the ideal. So how did we get from this and gambling? How does that all fit in? Well, we're talking about the deeper problem, the attitude behind, I want something quick, I want it easy, I want it now, I want to get out of this now. But God gave you a recipe for getting out of financial trouble. Work with your hands. Work with your hands. Mind your own business. And if something does come up, then that's fine. But permanently depending is not okay. And then trying to get that easy way out is not God's recipe. Speaking of getting something for free, I'll give you this one last Bible story and then we'll end the lesson. In 1 Chronicles chapter 21, David commits this grievous sin of doing a census of God's people. And you might think, why is doing a census of God's people such a disrespect toward God? That's not the lesson, but basically he didn't trust God. So he puts out this census, and God punishes him by giving him a choice of three punishments. He says you can have 3 years of famine, you can have 3 months of war, or you can have 3 days of pestilence. And David can't choose. David just says, let me fall into your hands, O Lord. So he does. And God chooses the 3 days of pestilence, and they lost 76,000 people. Well, the angel of the Lord comes to David and says, you need to offer some sacrifices to God at a Jebusite's house named Ornan. You need to use his threshing floor. So he goes to Ornan the Jebusite and says, I want to use your threshing floor to offer up sacrifices to God. And Ornan says, you got it. Not only can you do that, but I want to give you the threshing floor. I want to give you the animals. I want to give you the wood. I want to give you everything as a handout. If I could put it like that. I want to give you this all for free. You remember David's response? He says, no, no. I will not offer anything to God that does not cost me anything. In fact, he goes on to say, not only will I not receive this, but I'm going to pay full price, charge me the MSRP. Our lives are living sacrifices. And if we're trying to get by in this life, easy, quick, easy problems, just let them get away. I want the answer that leads me out of this in 30 minutes of gambling. We don't understand what David understood. Our lives are supposed to cost us something. It should cost us the time and the energy. And jobs do hurt. You know, there's a lot of time that goes into job. And there's a lot of stress. And you know what? That's one of the punishments for sin. Every time I'm driving home from work and I'm ready to pull my hair out, I think about the garden. It's good that work hurts me. Because I think about the problem of sin and I think about the salvation that's in Christ Jesus. So don't look for the easy way out. Please get out your songbooks and turn to the Song of Invitation. I told some people that I was going to preach on gambling, and the response was good. Some of you said, that's great. I hope that doesn't mean that there's a gambling problem here. And I don't think that there is. But I want to say something. If you are a gambler, you and me, we're not all that different. Because if I approved anything, I hope that what I've proved is that the problem's not gambling. It's deeper than that. And some of those things that I put up on the board, I struggle with. I struggle with being content with food and clothing. So I am struggling with the same things that you are struggling with if you're gambling. So we don't want to shame you. We don't want you to... I want you to feel the sting of sin, but I don't want you to feel so ashamed that you wouldn't be able to talk with our elders about it or come forward and have us pray about it. If you're subject to the gospel call, the waters of baptism behind me are ready. You can be baptized into Jesus Christ, and He'll save your soul. He'll take away all your sins, because that baptism will put you into the death of Jesus, where the blood is. Will you come? As together we stand and sing.